Welcome to the Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series, a presentation of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the Springfield campus of the University of Illinois and MPR Illinois. I'm Barbara Ferrara. The UIS Lincoln Legacy Lecture Series calls on scholars and policy experts to talk about issues that engaged Abraham Lincoln and the citizens of his era, and issues that are still timely today. The subject of this, the 13th annual lectures, is Lincoln and voting rights, with historical background marking the 50th anniversary of the U.S. Voting Rights Act, featuring Dr. Michael Vorenberg, Professor of History at Brown University, and Dr. Ronald Keith Gaddy, Professor of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma. We'll begin with Dr. Vorenberg's lecture, Voting Rights and the Meaning of Freedom, the View from the Civil War Era.
What I want to do today is to try to set a context for you of what voting meant in Lincoln's time and in Lincoln's world, because that's a different time and different world than our own. And it helps us understand, I think, a little bit about Lincoln's evolution in this, because it's an evolution that involves not just his attitudes towards race, towards African Americans, but it requires a whole rethinking of what voting really means. And of course, in the years that followed, we continue to rethink what voting means, and this being the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, we haven't quite figured it out yet. So we're dealing with different rules, a different time, and really a different environment altogether when it comes to voting. The voting in Lincoln's era was something that was done often. And by that, I don't mean many times in a day, as we often talk about in Illinois, but rather many times in a given year, even a season, because there was always someone being elected and therefore speeches to be made. And whether it was for the alderman or the mayor or what have you. And so it was a ritual, and it was a social event, and it was high entertainment. So George Caleb Bingham, one of our great artists of the era, painted two very famous paintings about elections. This one, Stump Speaking on the March calendar, so this is a speech given in March, and we see the people being entertained, children are there present, they're being effectively indoctrinated into the art of voting. You notice, I hope, that everyone there is white. Not everyone there is male, but that certainly is relevant. The more famous of the Bingham paintings on voting is this one, which is titled County Election. It's from 1854. And this is one of my favorite paintings that captures voting of the time. And really, it has in it so many of the emblematic things to know about 19th century voting in the United States, especially in smaller towns or rural communities. Voting could happen anywhere. It didn't happen in the quaint public school down the street. The most common place it would happen would be in a tavern. And the voting judge, the administrators would stand behind usually, and the voters in front on an elevated way so people could look up and see who was voting. There would be probably equally important, the entertainment that's going on around the site would be common. People waiting to vote while they're waiting, what are they doing? Well, both parties or whatever parties were out there would make sure there would be a lot of free liquor around. This was to make sure how do you get people to turn out to vote? This was the way. And so what you see here are people drinking and the effects of the drinking. So the one African American, if you can see over on the left side, is actually serving alcohol. And this is the world in which, if you think about African Americans in the public space and where their voting is occurring, this is how it would occur. And meanwhile, there's a number of people up on the porch. There's people actually who are allowed to challenge a voter, to say, are you really who you say you are? And this becomes an issue because challenges to voting are done on the spot. And often, the moment of what we would think of as voter registration is being done on the spot as well. So that voting is a much more fluid kind of process. It's done much more in reputation. It's highly entertaining. Where we might think of this most pure place of the ballot box, of the voting box, the voting booth, is quite different. You can see there's no shielding. It is a secret ballot, to be sure. But, and I'll say more about that in a second, but really, how secret is anything in this kind of climate? And I mentioned the secret ballot, so you just get a flavor of certain, of what tickets look like. This is, tickets would usually be printed by the newspaper of the town. And often, and they were completely partisan, right? So if you read the Republican newspaper, just to go to Lincoln's time, they'd have the ticket and you'd rip that ticket out, let's say, if the Democratic paper, rip that ticket out. So it was all taken care of for you. So these are from different wards of an area. Here's another scene of voting where you can see these challengers to the voting being done. A young boy who's tried to sneak in and vote is being escorted away. The gentleman on the right, though, you see what those gentlemen, they're spotters, right? They're trying to find the fraud. They're trying to find the people they can turn away. Back to tickets, though. Tickets themselves are artistic works of really wonderful material culture of voting. And so these are all tickets from the 1860 election. And you can see that in contrast to our tickets today, there's artwork, right? So you can know what your candidate looks like. We think about voting today and issues around non-English speakers. On the right is a German-only ballot. The ballot's in German for Lincoln. The way voting is done is that you would typically pick your ticket, and it would be either, in this case, a Democrat or a Republican ticket or a Constitutional Union ticket. And you could normally drop your ballot and the ticket stands, but you could also split your ticket, quite literally. You'd rip off, okay, I like the Republican candidate for president, take that off and drop it, and I like the Democratic candidates for Congress, we'll drop those off. So, you know, the whole way voting is done, and when you're doing all this with the paper, right, there are people all around you. So the idea that this is a purely secret ballot is a question, and that's hugely important when you think about voting and how voting would work once African Americans get the ballot, because none of this changes much in terms of procedure. After 1870, after the 15th Amendment is adopted. Lincoln actually didn't have much to say about the vote prior to, and voting rights generally, prior to becoming president. But one of the interesting things he says about voting before he becomes president is this, and we have it from his time when he's running for the legislature, when he's in Illinois. And he actually makes this statement to the editor, and this is in New Salem, Illinois. "I go for all sharing the privileges of the government who assist in bearing its burdens. Consequently, I go for admitting all whites to the right of suffrage who pay taxes or bear arms," and then in parentheses, "by no means excluding females." And there's a lot in this statement, right? The idea is that voting for Lincoln at this moment in 1836 is not a right, but a privilege. And what's the difference, right? So, and by the way, he hasn't worked this out yet, and he would evolve, and I don't think he had worked this out at all by the time he died. But one thing that's clear is that the rights of free people were rights that were either natural rights, that is, God-ordained rights, such as the right to be free, and this he believed from an early age extended, should extend to all people. But they could also include rights created by man, which we would tend to call civil rights, and ultimately Congress would call civil rights beginning in 1866 when they go to enforce the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. For the first time, they start to use this phrase, civil rights. But then there's something called privileges, which is privileges that are enjoyed by those who actually share the burden. That is, there's a burden involved in government, there's the obligation. And if you are paying that obligation, then you deserve some type of privilege. And who bears those burdens? And here he includes women who pay taxes. And he's perhaps making a joke because he knows women aren't bearing arms. And others have used this statement to say this is a joke, meant as a joke, because who would let a woman vote? Michael Burlingame has made the argument, and I think quite rightly, that Lincoln is taking the logic to its logical end, which is that women should vote. So it's a really interesting moment. But he says whites only, and that does stick with us, and that presents a problem. What does he think about the freeborn blacks of Illinois? And there are some, and of course many. And do they get to vote, those men or women? No, they don't. And it remains a real problem. That is Lincoln's position on voting for freeborn or any African-American who's living in the North. Illinois tries to pass a constitution that includes such a provision during the Civil War. Lincoln says nothing about it while he's in the White House. So he says whites only. But I do think that there's something about this burdens of the government. I do think that part of the reason why he doesn't do it is, first of all, politics. But another is I don't think his imagination had been stretched yet to imagine that African Americans were or could bear the burden of the government. For the African Americans, he knew they played a very small role in society, and by and large, he just didn't think of them mainly as taxpayers, and they certainly were excluded from the militia, so this was not to be considered. As far as slaves went, they were, to use a modern term, socially dead. It's Orlando Patterson, the sociologist, who talks about slavery as social death. And in this way, I think Lincoln thinks of them as people who slaves can't bear a burden of society, and they are excluded. And only after they would become free during his time as president could he begin to even fathom this notion that they would bear a burden. Part of course, what leads to them bearing a burden during the Civil War, now to jump ahead quite a bit, to the 1860s, is of course military service. And I just mentioned that Illinois, like almost all the states in the Union, limited militia service to whites only. And the Civil War, of course, is going to change that drastically. And African American service in the Civil War will be crucial, a turning point, the thing that makes Lincoln, probably more than anything else, refuse to ever consider retracting the Emancipation Proclamation. It's also during the Civil War that voting becomes an issue again, because with the fact that you have these soldiers in the field, it raises the necessary issue that when the vote happens, and here I'm not thinking about presidential elections, but about every election. Every year during the Civil War, there are elections. In 62, there's congressional elections. In 63, there's a couple of gubernatorial elections. And 64, of course, the famous, famous elections, including Lincoln's own reelection. You have soldiers in the field. And how are they going to vote? And the United States hasn't really dealt with this to this scale ever before. And so Lincoln has to preside over this question and to figure it out. Now, he's a party man, and he's no fool, and he wants to make sure that the soldiers vote because he knows, quite rightly, that they're more likely, at least in most cases, to vote for him. Those who are still loyal to McClellan's running against him, are a bit of a threat. But nonetheless, we have for the first time in 1864 this period where soldiers are voting in the field. And it's a really interesting moment. Lincoln allows it. He also encourages, if not voting in the field, the more common thing, which is to allow the soldiers to go home to vote. And in fact, I think if Lincoln had chosen to leave the White House and go back to Illinois, he would have voted himself. But that's the only way he would have voted, and because he was still an Illinois voter at that time, which is another reason why he wouldn't have voted in Washington, D.C. But voting in the field causes a different type of problem than the voting anywhere else. Look at the commanding officers standing as they watch these soldiers turning in their ballots. And the stories are really quite remarkable. This is, a better image of what it looks like. What you have here is the civilian, right, who's brought the tickets to the camp where the soldiers are stationed and is distributing the tickets. Who wants a Republican ticket? Who wants a Democratic ticket? And this is what it really looks like on the ground as people are thinking, well, gee, what am I going to do? And their friends, their comrades are looking on and their superior officers. And there isn't the same sort of checking on these things as there is elsewhere, but you got to believe there's peer pressure. And there's been a recent book by Jonathan White on this is excellent that suggests just how much of a menace many of these soldier voters felt by people who were regulating these affairs. Lincoln certainly heard these charges. He felt he was limited in what could be done about them. But when we talk about voting and developments in voting rights, I think this is one that we have to remember. And it relates directly, of course, to the way that voting would change that Lincoln did care deeply about, and that is has to do with African Americans. Because African Americans, beginning really right at the start of the war, but officially with federal bureaucracy in 1863 with the Bureau of Colored Troops, become soldiers. And many of these, most of them are former slaves. Many are freeborn African Americans. And that distinction, former slave versus freeborn, it becomes important in law. Lincoln, in his debates with Douglas when he's running in 1858, says that I am not in favor of Negro citizenship. He goes beyond that, though, and says that he is fine with the state of Illinois denying or granting citizenship. His problem with the Dred Scott case of 1857 is that it takes that power away from the states. It makes citizenship, this is his reading of Dred Scott, which isn't quite right, but it makes citizenship fully denied to black citizens. It means that the states, even if they want to, cannot give citizenship to African Americans. And for Lincoln, this is not conscionable because he still believes in the state's power to make laws around citizenship generally, and certainly, and most importantly, around voting. And I think he held that belief to his end. When he endorses voting in his last speech, when he's talking about it, it is a specific endorsement in one place, Louisiana. And he has Louisiana in mind, that is voting at the state level of Louisiana. The 15th Amendment, a national amendment that would prohibit exclusion of voting everywhere, by states everywhere, that was, I think, beyond the realm of not just his, but most people's idea in 1865. But Lincoln changes on this, like I said, and he grows into this notion of the vote being a privilege to what I would think of as the vote being more a fundamental right of protection of freedom. He believed in African American freedom. He showed that during the war. But how do you secure freedom, really? Well, first and foremost, you have to win the war. And so that was high on the agenda. But you have to protect it in other ways, too. Lincoln, as president, he comes to see the vote in different ways. More important, I think he comes to see African Americans in different ways, as soldiers, as I mentioned. I think the crucial turning point for him comes in early 1864. And it's a moment I'll go into a little bit of detail here. And I have to give just some background that Louisiana, and New Orleans in particular, is a remarkable place prior to the Civil War. It's a place where there is a significant middle or upper middle class of African Americans who are freeborn and take pride in the fact that they were freeborn. Many of them take pride in the fact that they served with Andrew Jackson in the War of 1812. And they are known sometimes as the gens de couleur because they, most of them speak French. They are from French families, and they're part of this cosmopolitan community, French and often Spanish-speaking people. And early on in the war, they're advocating for African-American service in the military. In fact, they were the first to serve in the military, and first of African-Americans to serve. But of course, they're also advocating for the vote. They, even before Frederick Douglass starts saying things like, once the black man puts down the bayonet, that is, the war is over, let him have the ballot. Well before that, these men are advocating for the vote, and they collect a massive number of signatures of their community, and they send it, and they bring it, excuse me, to Washington in the form of a petition that the citizens be allowed to vote of Louisiana. And this is led by two men, Louis-Charles Jouvenet and Arnold Bertineau, both very deeply involved in the New Orleans Tribune, an African-American newspaper of the area. When they come to Washington, and they're in Washington for a bit, they meet with with Lincoln, and they also meet with Charles Sumner. And it's Sumner who works with them on this language. And they are swayed by Sumner and others, but probably Sumner most of all, the senator from Massachusetts, to change the language so that it's for all Negroes, not just those who are freeborn. But it's interesting because I mention this because the freeborn thing is a really crucial part of American law and American ways of thinking. That is, that if you are born in the country, it gives you a certain status, regardless of color. That notion would ultimately make its way into the 14th Amendment, which would establish in the Constitution for the first time what we call birthright citizenship. Regardless of your parentage, if you're born in this country, you're a citizen. That then has huge implications for voting, still today. And so that kind of language has made it into New Orleans as well. Lincoln meets these people, and it's a remarkable moment because he's been to New Orleans, but he's never met people from this community. And he's quite bowled over. These people have a formal education, which Lincoln never had. These people speak 2 to 3 languages. Lincoln spoke only one, and that some accused him of not speaking very well. And so he realizes that his notions of who blacks can be as potential voters are wrong. They're just wrong. His notions of what they can do in bearing the burdens of government is terrifically wrong, because not only can they fight, they can write newspapers, editorials, they can circulate petitions, they pay a lot of taxes in New Orleans. And this is just this group. Think of the 4 million to come and what they could do as well. It was later in the week, a few days later, that he then writes the famous letter to the governor of Louisiana, Michael Hahn, and this is the letter. For your private consideration, see how he's written private on the upper left. I won't read it, but that is whether some of the people freed, and by that he means soldiers and the very intelligent. That's the phrase he uses. Does that mean literate? Probably, but we don't quite know what he has in mind there. And so that's the language of March 1864, and a year later he goes public with it in what we now know to be his last speech, his last public address, in which he says, again, using that language, "It is unsatisfactory to some that the elector franchise is not given to the colored men. I would myself prefer that it were now conferred on the very intelligent and on those who serve our cause as soldiers." That Lincoln had expanded his notions of who could be a voter. Now, the question we're left with, and which we simply don't have a single answer to, is would he have made voters immediately of all the freed people that were going to be free by the war? And that's a tough question because, you see, when he gives this speech on April 11th, 1865, the war is not over. Now, that right away doesn't sound right, because if you know your history, you say, well, gee, one of the reasons he's giving speeches on Reconstruction is because 2 days before this, Robert E. Lee has surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant. Richmond has fallen the week before that. So, of course, the war is over. The war is not over. Johnston still has an army larger than Lee's in the field. There's a war in the West going on still. Lincoln's very worried about how this war is going to end. He knows Union victory will ultimately be the end, but he has no idea what that shape of that peace is going to look like. And what is happening is that he's beginning to work this out, and only beginning, which is, of course, one of many tragedies of his death. But one thing is that he's been convinced by the example of Louisiana, by the men he's met that I talked about, by the Reconstruction that's going on there, that the African Americans in Louisiana, not just those of a higher class, but all of them, will need protection. They will need protection from violence, especially once they muster out. And Lincoln was really dwelling on this issue, right? What happens to these African Americans once they muster out and go home? Then they lack the protection of the Union uniform and of the guns they carry, potentially, although they would have the option, as we now know, to buy those guns. Few took that option because the guns were too expensive, disproportionately expensive, by the way, compared to what they cost today. And so they need some type of protection, and I think he had been swayed more by Frederick Douglass than anyone else, that the best way of protection was the vote itself. Would he have come to the 15th Amendment? Perhaps, perhaps not. And the fact that we don't know the answer to that remains one of the most troubling parts about his assassination. And therefore, we can't even begin to think about what he would say about the Voting Rights Act or the preclearance issue. But I've got a pretty good idea about what I think he would say. I'll stop there.
That was Dr. Michael Vorenberg, professor of history at Brown University and author of Final Freedom, The Civil War, The Abolition of Slavery, and the 13th Amendment. You're listening to Lincoln and Voting Rights, a presentation of the University of Illinois Springfield's 13th Annual Lincoln Legacy Lectures. Next, Dr. Ronald Keith Gaddy, professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma, discusses citizenship and voting rights in the modern era.
We could talk for days, weeks, years about this topic, but I'm going to dovetail off of something that Michael said, which is this notion of the importance of the vote and why it mattered. In May 17, 1957, Dr. Martin Luther King appeared with a group of other leaders from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to take to task the federal government on the third year anniversary of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision for their lack of progress in the implementation of this decision. The High Court had asked them to act with all deliberate speed, and those who supported integration heard the word speed. Those who opposed it, such as Senator Byrd from Virginia, heard the word deliberate, which they took to mean deliberate, which meant never. And indeed, in Virginia, some counties actually shut down their public schools, and it was permissible for a child who was in first grade in Virginia in 1957 to have never attended classes with a student of another race by the time they graduated high school in 1969. Okay. It's not until 1970 we see full and effective compliance with the Brown decision. But in this speech, which is one of the most powerful and critical speeches Dr. King gave, he made the observation, give us the ballot, and we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights, that we will elect the lawmakers who will write the laws, who will implement the change that's embodied in the Brown decision. And Dr. King did not see this fully realized, but he did see the Voting Rights Act. He did see the government, 8 years later, finalize a piece of legislation, which is one of the most extraordinary pieces of legislation in the history of the United States. It's the most extraordinary exercise of federal government authority over the states outside of Reconstruction. Indeed, it's considered to be the hallmark piece of legislation of what historians and political scientists call the Second Reconstruction. And it is a law which has been knocked back significantly by the U.S. Supreme Court. The importance of the vote is that it is the fundamental manifestation of citizenship. It's the exercise of sovereignty. It's the opportunity of the individual to have the weight of their preference measured, to choose representatives who will in turn act in their interest. It means that they matter. Thomas Jefferson knew this thing. He argued for broadened suffrage in his debates with George Mason regarding the vote in Virginia in the 18th century and regarding the apportionment of political power. Jefferson was an advocate for equal population apportionment and had extended arguments with George Mason and also with James Madison to this regard. He argued early on that voting in the 18th century should not just be a function of property ownership, but also be extended to those who had borne arms, that the militia should have access to the vote. One of the things we know about the American experience across the three epochs of American political history, the first epoch being defined by the Revolution and the framing of the Republic, the second being the Civil War and the reframing of the Republic after the war, and the third being defined in the New Deal era, the modern epoch, is that the notion of citizenship both in terms of obligation and opportunity, expand and grow. That we have consistently expanded access to the vote and expanded electoral control over politics. Now, the high watermark in many ways is the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and it occurs at the exact halfway point in a 100-year stretch of the rolling back of Jim Crow, the rolling back of suffrage restrictions in the United States, the peaking of these efforts in the 1960s, and then most recently, for the first time, the turning back of a major piece of civil rights legislation by the High Court with the overturning of Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, why would we care about this? Why would we worry? Why would it matter? Well, one thing we have to consider is that in American politics, it is almost impossible to disentangle race, economics, and politics. Okay? It is an almost impossible task to do this thing. If you're familiar with this photograph, you've probably seen it in black and white. You probably saw it in a civics textbook or a history text, and it's in the section about the Great Depression. And it's supposed to show a bunch of people standing in a relief line, waiting for public relief underneath this billboard that shows this happy, prosperous couple. And most often when this photograph is shown, it's to illustrate the contrast of the reality of the Depression versus the marketing of prosperity. The thing about this photograph is, this is a WPA Artist Project photograph of African Americans standing in line for Red Cross relief in Louisville, Kentucky after the 1937 Ohio River flood. Now, in the black and white photograph, usually it's shrunk down to a level you cannot always tell these are African Americans standing in line. Larger photographs make it quite clear. When colorized, it becomes fully evident. The reason I've chosen this image is for a variety of reasons. One is that if we look at the city of Louisville, which is in a southern-like state, Kentucky, okay? Southern-like or southern-light, depending on how you choose to characterize it. Louisville, and I'm from there, so Louisville is a place that has southern pretensions and also southern habits. It had Jim Crow laws. It had segregated schools. It had segregated public facilities, segregated water fountains. It did not have the Jim Crow voting laws that we find in the Deep South or even in the Rim South, but it had a variety of southern pretensions. It was highly segregated in terms of the populations. In fact, Louisville has a strict racial segregation ordinance in place as of World War I. And the residual of this is that you have the African-American community living largely in the west side of the city, more prone to flooding. And after the flood, the white community withdraws to the hill country surrounding the city. And economic growth and development moves in this direction, and jobs and development start to leave areas around the west end of Louisville. Okay? This is an early illustration of what happens with white flight around cities around the United States, where whites flee to the suburbs and resegregate in the wake of the knocking down of Jim Crow laws in the cities, especially in the South. Kevin Cruz does a remarkable job of talking about this in his book about Atlanta, White Flight. But the reason it matters is that there are consequences to politics. We look at the New Deal era when African-American votes move heavily over towards FDR and the Democrats. This is the beginning of the black realignment that's realized with the Voting Rights Act. Nonetheless, many of the policies designed to enact relief and to enact long-term economic security that come out of the New Deal are nonetheless discriminatory. Agricultural workers and domestic workers are excluded from the Social Security system. In the South, this means 80% of blacks who are in employ in the South are not in the Social Security system initially. We find that benefits from the Agricultural Adjustment Act are directed disproportionately towards white rather than black farmers. We find that USDA policy discriminates against black farmers, litigation going on about this for decades. We discover that the monies that come in to modernize agriculture are directed largely towards larger landowning farmers. And mechanization displaces rural black sharecropping populations as well, or creates a competition basis that starts to drive black farmers out of the marketplace if they happen to own land. So even in this period when we have broad-based relief underway through a liberal democratic administration, we discover that the ability to build security that can lead to intergenerational security is being denied. I pulled some stats before we came in because I'm a political scientist and we like numbers. And in fact, I need to address something right now about political scientists and time, okay? We see time as a great quasi-experiment, which is we can step in, look for an intervention, control for an event, and figure out what would have happened if you had not had the intervention. Historians see the time as a village that they can travel and visit from time to time, and it's very real to them. You know, and I'm a historian at heart, so I like to go back to these villages myself. But in 1950, the ratio of white to black income in the United States is that the median white household earns 185% of that of the median black household. The numbers are more pronounced in the South. By 1970, that number's down to 163%. It goes up to 172% by 1990, down to 158% in 2000, and it's back up to 170% as of last year. So in other words, in 65 years, we've made almost no net gains in the relative difference of earnings between African-American and Anglo-white households in the United States. Intergenerational transfers of wealth in terms of inheritance are far smaller among African-American families than white families, okay? Levels of incarceration among young black men are far higher than that of young white men. Homicide rates are far higher than the African-American community. Juvenile detention rates are higher. Asset forfeitures by law enforcement are higher among racial minorities and among Anglo-whites. We have a variety of interventions in terms of the implementation of facially neutral policy that continues to exacerbate economic disadvantage between African-Americans in particular and Anglo-whites, but also more recently, Hispanics in the United States. Give us the vote, we will make the laws. So what did the Voting Rights Act do? What's the purpose of the act? Well, if you recognize this visual, you'll see three names on it, Michael Schwerner, Andrew Goodman, and James Cheney. And many of you know who these men were. These were young men with the Congress on Racial Equality. In the summer of 1964, they were working to register voters in Philadelphia, Mississippi. They were detained and arrested by the sheriff, then released, intercepted by the Ku Klux Klan, murdered on the road back to Meridian, Mississippi, and it took 44 days to uncover them. This is one example of the variety of forms of political violence that we saw, especially in the South, not only in the distant era of the end of Reconstruction and the emergence of Jim Crow, but in the midst of the Civil Rights era. And there is complicity between law enforcement and extra-legal authority in the form of the Ku Klux Klan, which is widespread and manifest not only in the South, but also in the Midwest in the early part of the 20th century. This violence is followed up 9 months later by violence against voting rights marchers, civil rights marchers at Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. The visuals compel change. Lyndon Johnson asked for the toughest goddamn voting rights law that he can get from his attorney general. The purpose of the Voting Rights Act in general is to deploy the power of the federal government, the legal power of the federal government, to disentangle and undo Jim Crow voting practices and to protect that vote because it's evident that violent force will be used against it in addition to legal force. It's not that the government had not been trying before 1965, okay? It's not that they haven't been trying. In 1957, 1960, and again in 1964, Congress had passed laws designed to allow the Department of Justice to bring lawsuits in the South against jurisdictions that were discriminating against black voters. The Congress had passed laws to protect voting records from destruction so that evidence could be preserved in order to test whether or not discrimination was underway. George Wallace was a state judge who had refused to comply with federal registrars, for example. It's where he made his name and undertook his first run for governor in 1958. In Mississippi, when federal investigators asked for voting records, in all but three Mississippi counties, they were informed that the records had mysteriously burned in a fire. Now, I don't know if there was a serial electoral arsonist at work in Mississippi that summer, but it was evident that you were not going to get good faith compliance out of the Deep South, out of state and local officials. Indeed, Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett, very colorful individual in his old right, made the observation that a legislature can change laws faster than courts can overturn them. So that so long as you went into court to litigate in one place against one law, in one community, or one particular act, the legislature could just go in and find a new and novel way to not comply. And this is one of the things I'll give dubious credit to Southern legislators. They are brilliant legislators. And they will come up with amazing vehicles and devices to not comply. So we couldn't be one at a time in it, for lack of a better way to put it. It was evident that extraordinary measures were required to overcome discrimination. This is what the Voting Rights Act 1965 does. In particular, there are five provisions of the act you need to be familiar with, and I'm going to go through these quickly because I'm cognizant of time. It suspended the use of literacy tests, put into place a mechanism to challenge discriminatory voting laws anywhere in the U.S. This is known as Section 2 of the Act. This is basically an operational form of the 15th Amendment as law. And this provision requires either an individual or the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney, to go into court, challenge the voting practices of a jurisdiction, and to demonstrate based upon the burden of proof residing with the plaintiff that a discriminatory, well actually at the time of the original act, discriminatory intent was at work causing a discriminatory effect on minority voters. This is later amended in the 1982 Act. The Act provided for a means to place jurisdictions who had committed particularly egregious acts of discrimination under the administrative authority of the Department of Justice. This is known as Section 3, also called the pocket trigger. It's worth remembering that term, the pocket trigger. It's only been used 7 times, but we may see more use of it in the future. But most important, it provided a mechanism for identifying the most egregiously discriminatory jurisdictions in the United States. And these are mainly in the Deep South, plus Virginia and North Carolina. It's a 2-part mechanism. The coverage formula identifies any county that's had less than 50% voter turnout or voter registration in the 1964 election, and has made use of a test or device for the purpose of qualifying people to vote. If you trip both of these provisions, your election laws are frozen in place by Section 5 of the Act, and any change in your local practices or law has to be approved by either the Department of Justice or by the D.C. Court, by the federal court in the District of Columbia. This is what's known as the preclearance provision. It takes a right of the state to conduct elections, freezes their laws in place, and requires them to come to the national government to seek approval to change their existing practices. It's an extraordinary change in the relationship between the states and the national government. What the states must prove, and they now bear the burden, is that they have not committed an act of retrogression against the voting rights and the ability to equally access the ballot of minority voters in the affected jurisdiction. Now, the states go to court, and they sue Attorney General Katz and back, demanding relief, complaining that this is overreach, violation of states' rights, an extraordinary usurpation of the ability of the states, violation of their equal sovereignty, and they fail. The Supreme Court comes in and makes the observation that there is an insidious evil at work in the South, and Congress had to act. Insidious evil at work, important term. Probably the most powerful language ever used by the high court in describing the behavior of a state. Okay? And here's the thing, the law works. Terrell County, Georgia, which was and is about a 66% African-American county, in 1956 had a total of 48 black registered voters out of roughly 3,000 registered voters in the county. 1.8% of all potentially eligible African Americans in the county were registered to vote. They are sued by the Department of Justice under the Civil Rights Act 1960, under the auspices of the 14th, 15th Amendment. Department of Justice prevails. Plaintiffs prevail. Registrars are brought in to supervise literacy tests, And by 1962, the number of African-American voters in Terrell County soared to 98. Okay? Now, the thing is, you know, it's we sit here in distance and time. This is a tragedy. This is tragic. That in the face of obvious discrimination, the authority of the national government is able to double the number of black voters in a community where less than 2% of the eligible black vote have been registered. Then comes the Voting Rights Act. Federal registrars are deployed. By 1967, 54% of African Americans in Terrell County are registered to vote, 2,200 people. By 1980, there are 2,280 registered blacks, 2,182 registered whites. For the first time, the majority residents of the county are also the majority of the electorate. And in 2012, there were 3,427 African Americans registered to vote, 2,350 whites. Voter registration rates for whites and blacks are roughly comparable. Over 82% of voters of both races are registered to vote. The act succeeded. African-American office holding has soared in covered jurisdictions. In sum, the longer a jurisdiction is covered by the Voting Rights Act, the more likely black voters are to be registered, to participate, and to be able to elect candidates of choice across the South. Now, here's the thing, though. The emergency provisions I described were temporary provisions. They're only meant to be enforced for about 5 years. But the act was renewed and extended in 1970 and then again in 1975 for periods of 5 and 7 years. The goal of this type of sunset legislation was to force Congress to come back and revisit the problem. Okay? Well, by 1981, the act is coming up for renewal again. And to be honest, Congress is getting tired on this issue. And they've also had a recent decision out of Mobile, Alabama, which has made the implementation of the act much more difficult. The city of Mobile case held that a definite narrow intent standard had to be applied when challenging a law under Section 2 of the act. So in renewing the act, Orrin Hatch and Bob Dole and their other co-sponsor, Strom Thurmond, and for what it's worth, Strom was endorsed by the NAACP in 1946 for election as governor. I will make note of that. I think it was his high watermark. Well, what they do is they lower the evidentiary standard in Section 2 from an intent standard to an effect standard. So it's easier to win against a jurisdiction that's probably discriminating against black voters. Put another way, as one U.S. attorney put it, we're dealing with smart people here. They're not going to just show their intent in the open. Okay, we're not going to be able to uncover it. So the Voting Rights Act moves to an effects test. The Supreme Court upholds it. But the thing they don't do is they don't update the coverage trigger. Section 4 of the Act had periodically been renewed, and in renewing it, the evidence that was used always came from the most recent election. This is the voter turnout plus historic use of tests and device criteria I talked about earlier, and which is in your handout on the Voting Rights Act under Section 4. They freeze the evidence in 1972. So we use electoral data from 1972 to explain whether or not a jurisdiction in 1982 moving forward should be covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which freezes laws in place. Now, in renewing the law and setting the new trigger, they extend the law for 25 years. So it won't have to be addressed again until 2007, at which point in time, hopefully, all these guys have been able to retire and don't have to deal with the issue again. And then what happens is two things. First of all, the new version of Section 2 is wildly successful. We see a tremendous increase in the creation of majority-minority county commission and state legislative districts to allow black office holders to be elected. We see a substantial expansion of Hispanic representation in the American Southwest. We also see successful litigation in places like Chicago, where there's a Section 2 case brought in 1985 that changes the structure of the Chicago City Council. But the other thing that happens is we see an increased politicization of strategy regarding the use of Section 5. The Bush White House and their Department of Justice starts incorporating criteria from Section 2 of the Act into the Section 5 review of redistricting plans. And this allows them to compel the widespread implementation of majority-minority congressional and state legislative districts across the South without actually having to sue and demonstrate discriminatory effect. This also has the practical effect of isolating Black and Hispanic voters in predominantly Black and Hispanic majority districts. And over the next decade, the number of Democratic congressmen from the South falls by half, because white Democrats have been relying on biracial electoral coalitions to win election. But the other thing that happens is we have the beginning of pushback. And most of you probably don't recognize this gentleman. He's actually a friend of mine. His name is Edward Blum. Okay, Ed Blum is at the American Enterprise Institute. And Edward has been a critic of the Voting Rights Act, contending the use of majority-minority districts creates a polarizing effect in politics, that coalitional politics are better for America. And in particular, he has contended and successfully financed litigation challenging aspects of the Voting Rights Act and its implementation. So in the 1990s, he bankrolled a series of challenges in Texas, Georgia, Virginia, and South Carolina that challenged the creation of these bizarrely shaped predominantly Black or predominantly Hispanic congressional districts. And these series of cases, the Shaw case, the Vera B. Bush, the Miller case out of Georgia, all go to the Supreme Court and significantly constrain the ability of the Department of Justice to use Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to compel the creation of new majority-minority opportunities. Then, when the Voting Rights Act was coming up for renewal, he started shopping for plaintiffs to challenge the coverage formula under Section 4 and the provisions of Section 5. And in brief, financed a case called Namudno, which challenged the ability of states to bail out from under coverage of the Voting Rights Act, and then financed the Shelby County case, which overturned the Section 4 coverage formula of the Voting Rights Act, you know, effectively emasculating the law. The Department of Justice still has the ability to review changes of elections, election law in states and jurisdictions tripped by Section 4, but we have no operational formula for determining who's covered right now because it was thrown out by the high court. And the principle that's used to do this is one called the Doctrine of Equal Sovereignty of the States. Now, this doctrine, which is advanced by Justice Roberts, has never been used in such an expansive fashion, and to my knowledge, has never been used to throw out an act of Congress before. But Justice Roberts had been leaving a set of acorns laying around in previous litigation, and it basically swept them up and brought them into this decision in Shelby County in 2013. The peculiar thing is, this didn't have to happen. I called it an avoidable tragedy in having a conversation a couple of years back at the time of the case. In 2006, Congress was given the opportunity to again renew and extend the Voting Rights Act, and they were cautioned by a variety of scholars to update the coverage formula to not use 1972 data, but to use more recent electoral data, or to come up with a new mechanism for determining who's covered by this law. They didn't take the opportunity. They renewed the law as was, attempted to tighten up other legal defects, and in the process, created a situation that made Mr. Blum's challenges not only ripe, but almost inevitable. And they did succeed. So where we stand now, in brief, is that Congress is confronted with a situation where the most powerful component of the Voting Rights Act is not available to the Department of Justice. And there are a variety of proposals that have been advanced regarding how to restore it. No one can get a handle on how to fix the coverage formula because of this one simple problem. When we designed the law in 1965, it was easy to tell who the demons were. They were geographically located. They were engaged in stark and obnoxious denial of voting rights. Okay? They were easy villains. They were easy to identify. The problems of voting rights in the United States now are not geographically concentrated. They're geographically dispersed. They exist around the United States and in places that we don't anticipate. Some of the worst racially polarized voting in the United States is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is the second most segregated city in the United States. Okay? We can't, if we could just agree upon two things, we could fix a Voting Rights Act. And the only two things we need to agree upon are, what's the problem, and how to define a trigger to cover that problem. And unfortunately, we will not get there because, in particular, the debate over the act is going to hang up on two issues. The first of these is the fact that the Republican Party is now a Southern party. It's not just that it's a Southern majority party, it's a Southern party. It's a Southernized party, increasingly dominated by states' rights elements who are highly critical of any federal intervention in any traditional state activity. A Republican congressional majority will not vote out a law that adversely affects the South in particular or states' rights in general. The second problem is for the rest of the country, we are not willing to admit that this is not just a Southern problem. It becomes conveniently Southern because it's been conveniently Southern for 150 years. So where that leaves us is with the irony of the Voting Rights Act. Now, this is Lyndon Johnson signing the original act, and you'll notice directly behind him is Dr. Martin Luther King. When Lyndon Johnson signed this law, it set off a realignment of American politics in the South. It took a long time to move. And it realigned in two ways. It moved African-American voters totally in the Democratic Party and over a half century gave them unprecedented power inside the Democratic Party, both in legislatures and in the National Party. But it also moved so much of the South away from the Democratic Party, so much of the border South away from the Democratic Party, that the prospects of electing a Democratic congressional majority are slim. In part because the nature of the implementation of the act, especially in redistricting, favors the packing of Black, Hispanic, and Democratic voters into districts that minimizes their impact on the broader electorate and forestalls more frequent Democratic majorities. Democratic House candidates got a majority of the vote for Congress in the last two elections, but did not win a majority of the seats in the U.S. House. Now, I'm going to stop there because I'm at the end of my time. I thank you very much for the opportunity to come and visit. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Ronald Keith Gatti, professor of political science at the University of Oklahoma and author of The Triumph of Voting Rights in the South. Been listening to Lincoln and Voting Rights, the subject of the 13th Annual Lincoln Legacy Lectures, a presentation of the Center for State Policy and Leadership at the Springfield campus of the University of Illinois and NPR Illinois. Theme music composed by Dennis Fisher, based on the 1865 James G. Clark song, Martyr of Liberty. Thanks for listening. I'm Barbara Ferrara.